Hey everybody, Marcus here. In the first part of this series, we tackled the deductive version of the Nawalt argument. By applying Platonic metaphysics, the Kantian analytic synthetic distinction, as well as Aristotle's law of identity, we managed to demonstrate how, as far as metaphysics is concerned, necessarily all women are like that. Though the argument allowed us to prove that all women are like that, it did not in any way help us determine what that is, which all women are like. Because of this, a defender of Nawalt can make the following counter-argument. Yes, perhaps indeed all women are like that in the way you describe. After all women eat, sleep, possess the attribute of age, height, weight, and so on. But it is not the case that they are all hypergamous or gynocentric. Your argument does not prove that that which you so claim all women are like necessarily includes hypergamy and gynocentrism. Therefore, although all women possess some qualities and therefore are all like that, it is not the case that they all possess the qualities you insist they do. As such, all women are not like that in the second sense. Now, the Nawalt defender has just presented something true. It is not necessarily the case that all women possess all the qualities that MGTOW say they do. MGTOW need to argue towards such claims, and we do. So, with all this said, let us resume the approach from the previous video and outline the premises of the Nawalt argument in its refined form. 1. MGTOW assert that all women are hypergamous and gynocentric, etc. 2. Counterexamples exist of women who are not hypergamous and who are not gynocentric, etc. 3. Therefore, not all women are like what MGTOW describe. This form of the Nawalt argument is more in line with most people's understanding of what Nawalt is claiming. Now, we need to take a look at the structure of this argument. First, we can immediately see that this argument is aggregate in nature. There are really two arguments that can be evaluated independently. The first of the two arguments would go as follows. 1. MGTOW assert that all women are hypergamous. 2. Counterexamples exist of women who are not hypergamous. 3. Therefore, not all women are like what MGTOW describe. The second argument would then go as follows. 1. MGTOW assert that all women are gynocentric. 2. Counterexamples exist of women who are not gynocentric. 3. Therefore, not all women are like what MGTOW describe. Let us call the first argument H, and the second argument G. Now, do MGTOW argue the conjunction of H and G, or do we argue the disjunction of H or G? Well, I would say that MGTOW argue the conjunction, meaning that a woman can be said to be like that if and only if she is both hypergamous and gynocentric. However, if she was only hypergamous but not gynocentric, then she is not like that. Also, if she is gynocentric but not hypergamous, then again, she would not be like that. Now, I have limited the claims made by MGTOW about women to two attributes, hypergamy and gynocentrism. It is also the case that MGTOW make additional claims of all women, claims such as in-group bias and many others. So it appears that when MGTOW assert a woman is like that, they are necessarily claiming that she possesses the conjunction of all attributes we have asserted as true of all women. Now, something very interesting happens here. For every attribute that is added to the list of what MGTOW claim is true of all women, it gets increasingly more difficult to maintain this conjunction, and it makes it increasingly easier to seemingly find a counterexample. In fact, by extending the list of assertions MGTOW make about women, we are making Nawalt a much more likely phenomenon. But if we take the disjunctive approach and assert that a woman only needs to possess one of the attributes MGTOW assert about women, then in turn, making the list longer has the opposite effect that we encountered in the conjunctive approach. It becomes harder and harder for an advocate of Nawalt to find an example of a woman who does not fit at least one of the criteria. Now, I have heard some MGTOW state that in order for a woman to be considered Nawalt, she must possess none of the attributes asserted of all women. This means the disjunctive approach is used while attempting to counter a Nawalt claim. But at the same time, the conjunctive claim would be made in asserting what like that is. Well, this is inconsistent. As such, we as MGTOW must either make the conjunctive claim or the disjunctive claim, and we must not use both when we find it convenient. As such, in order to stay consistent, I will take the position that MGTOW assert the conjunctive claim, that a woman must possess all the attributes asserted by MGTOW in order to be like that. And if any particular woman can be found to not possess one of those attributes, then she is considered a NAWALT. Okay, now that we have established under what conditions a woman is NAWALT and under which conditions she is not NAWALT, we need to show if indeed all women are like what MGTOW claimed them to be. Now, let us remember that the point of this video is to defeat the NAWALT argument. I'm not going to argue towards providing proof that all women possess the attribute of hypergamy, gynocentrism, etc. You know, that would fall well out of scope of what we are trying to achieve and would obfuscate our main goal. Also, it is not necessary to prove all women are hypergamous and gynocentric to defeat the NAWALT argument. Firstly, MGTOW have argued for female attributes inductively. This means MGTOW have relied on experience to verify their claims. Now, I do not mean anecdotal experience, though there's no shortage of that. No, I mean that MGTOW look at research and statistics, which are empirical in nature, therefore dependent on experience. In this way, it can be said that our first premise of the NAWALT argument, namely MGTOW assert that all women are hypergamous and gynocentric, has been argued inductively. The second premise, namely, counterexamples exist of women who are not hypergamous and who are not gynocentric, etc., is also argued inductively. The second premise looks towards experience in order to produce a particular example that is meant to disprove the first premise. Therefore, as a whole, the NAWALT argument presented in this video is inductive. Now, let us continue in the spirit of induction. At the outset, I would like to draw your attention to the word are, as presented in the first premise. What does it mean when MGTOW say that women are hypergamous, gynocentric, etc.? Well, it implies possession of something. And could it not also be said that to possess something is to have it? Well, surely it can. For if you are human, you have humanity. If you are sick, you have sickness. And in this way also, it also follows that when we say that women are hypergamous, gynocentric, etc., we are equally and interchangeably saying that women have hypergamy, that they have gynocentrism, and so on. Now, do we not also say that women have periods? Yes, we do. And when we say this, do we not mean that all women have periods? Well, yes, indeed, this is what we mean. But what if I produce a 6-year-old girl and a 60-year-old woman and say, look, not all women are like that. If I did this, you would laugh at me and my counterexamples. You would say to me, but Marcus, the 6-year-old will have hers when she hits puberty, and the 60-year-old stopped having hers when she hit menopause. But what if I then go out and find a dead 6-year-old and say to you, well, look, this one never had her period and never will. Not all women are like that again. Well, again, you would laugh at my counterexample. You would say to me, but Marcus, if she lived to puberty, she would have surely had her period. Now, let us look at the full NAWALT argument using our period example. 1. Everyone assert that all women have periods. 2. Counterexamples exist of women who do not have periods. 3. Therefore, not all women are like what everyone describes. Seemingly, even after providing 3 concrete examples to justify premise 2, we are left unsatisfied on the intuitive level. But somehow we have provided evidence for premise 2, and therefore demonstrated premise 2 as a true statement, and therefore proven logically that not all women have periods. What could have possibly gone wrong? How is it that we would completely reject such a NAWALT argument, even when faced with seemingly irrefutable proof? Perhaps the meaning with which we interpret the first premise is different than the strict logical nature of the words used. What if we rephrase this NAWALT argument to reflect the concise meaning we have in mind? If we do this, our NAWALT argument will align itself better with our intuition. 1. Everyone assert that all women have the potentiality for periods. 2. Counterexamples exist of women who do not have the potentiality for periods. 3. Therefore, Not all women are like what everyone describes. Now, we can clearly see that our three counterexamples can no longer be used to make premise 2 true. All three had the potentiality for periods. In this way, all women are like that, even though some seemingly actualize this potentiality, while others do not. What about the case of the 60-year-old? Does it not sound strange that a woman post-menopause possesses the potentiality for periods? Would the post-menopausal woman be a valid example to justify a period NAWALT? Well, you would indeed be wise in calling out this example. Let us try an account for this seemingly valid example of a period NAWALT. Now, the following is a story we usually imagine when we think of periods. A girl does not have periods until she hits puberty. Then she has periods until she hits menopause and stops having periods. Nothing uncontroversial about this. So, if we apply the language we have been using up to now, the same story could be told as follows. A girl has the potentiality for periods before she hits puberty. Between puberty and menopause, she actualizes her potentiality. Then after menopause, she stops actualizing her potentiality and loses the potentiality for periods. Now, is it not the case that we are really talking about two things when we use the word period? In the first case, we are talking about that event that occurs every 28 days for women from puberty to menopause. But in the second sense, we are talking about the process as a whole. So in the second sense, we can say that a period is in fact the process that begins at birth and ends at death, with the start and end of life not having involved any bleeding. The absence of bleeding after menopause is just as much part of the actualization of the potentiality of periods as the bleeding is during the time span between puberty and menopause. Is it not all part of the concept of period in the second sense? Well, surely it is. But this still may be unclear, so let me provide an analogy. Let us imagine how a building is constructed. First, the foundation is dug up and the scaffolding put up. Then the building itself is raised. But the construction process is not over when the building is raised, is it? No. After the building is raised, the scaffolding needs to be torn down and the construction site cleaned up. So in this way, the years before puberty are equivalent to laying down the foundation and setting up the scaffolding. Then the years between puberty and menopause are those where the building is raised. The years post-menopause are those in which the scaffolding is torn down and the construction site cleaned up. The process is deemed finished when death occurs. The potentiality of a period should then be understood as the process as a whole, and not only the middle time span. If we are to understand the potentiality of periods in this way, we can clearly see that the 60-year-old post-menopausal woman is not a period NAWALT. The 60-year-old is actualizing the potentiality of her period as is expected of the process as a whole. In fact, to find a period NAWALT, you would need to find a woman that fits one of the following descriptions. 1. A woman who bleeds before puberty. 2. A woman who bleeds only after menopause. 3. A woman who bleeds before puberty and after menopause. 4. A woman who does not bleed before puberty, does not bleed in the time between puberty and menopause, and who does not bleed after menopause. 5. A woman who bled before puberty, during the time between puberty and menopause, and after menopause. Only these 5 cases provide valid examples of a period NAWALT. Next, can it be said that a man exists who has the potentiality for periods? Well, surely not. Therefore, some potentialities are exclusive to one sex. In the case of periods, it is exclusive to women. Before we move on, I would like to clarify one more thing. Potentiality should not be understood as synonymous with the meaning we attribute to the concept of potential. For example, all human beings have the potentiality for language. Not all human beings have the potential for language. This can easily be understood in the case of a man alone on a desert island. Though he is fully capable in every way to acquire language, his situation simply forbids that possibility. There is no potential for this man to learn language, even though he possesses that potentiality. So, why did we bother with this huge digression into talk about periods? Well, We wanted to establish a few things. First, we demonstrated that when MGTOW say that women are hypergamous, gynocentric, etc., we are justified in stating that women can be equivalently said to have hypergamy, gynocentrism, etc. Next, we wanted to clarify what it means to have these attributes. We argued that to have these attributes, much like periods, was to have the potentiality of those attributes. We also explained how potentiality should be understood and demonstrated how seemingly obvious counterexamples can turn out not to be counterexamples at all. But let us tie all of this together and once again look at the Nawalt argument as it will look with these new concepts in place. To keep it simple, we will only work with the MGTOW concept of hypergamy. 1. MGTOW assert that all women have potentiality for hypergamy. 2. Counterexamples exist of women who do not have potentiality for hypergamy. 3. Therefore, not all women are like what MGTOW describe. So what does this mean? Well, a few things. Firstly, the object of discussion is potentiality and not individual actions. This means that if someone wants to cry Nawalt, they need to provide a concrete example of a woman who does not possess the potentiality of hypergamy. So it is not the case that someone can simply point to their mother and say, "Look, she stayed with my father all these years and never traded up." That sort of example is not sufficient to prove that she does not possess potentiality. All it means is that to your knowledge, you have not witnessed her trade up. Such an example implicitly assumes the following. 1. She was presented with opportunities to trade up but chose not to. 2. You have insight into what she currently considers trading up and has considered trading up at every opportunity presented to her. And 3. She will not trade up in the future. No, the standard of evidence is much higher than this. You know, it is said that the burden of proof rests with the person making a claim, and this is true. The burden of proof lays with MGTOW to demonstrate that all women indeed possess the potentiality of hypergamy. However, MGTOW do not need to demonstrate every woman has traded up, only that they all possess the compulsion to, the disposition to, the drive to, the potentiality to trade up. But inversely, when someone cries Nawalt, the burden of proof lays on the defender of Nawalt to find a woman who does not have the compulsion, drive, disposition, potentiality to trade up. Merely finding a woman who never traded up is not sufficient to demonstrate that potentiality for hypergamy does not exist in her. But if we wanted to find a woman who does not have potentiality for hypergamy, how would we go about this? And in our search, let us try to maximize the certainty that we have found her. Well, we would need to tackle the three skeptical assumptions that we have called out when our Nawalt defender decided to use his mother as an example. So let us tackle assumption one first. Namely, she was presented with opportunities to trade up, but chose not to. To do this, we would need to somehow create a catalog of all the opportunities presented to this Nawalt candidate. These opportunities would need to have some sort of way of being verified, and the decision made by the Nawalt candidate would also need to be known. How a defender of Nawalt would go about achieving this is, well, unclear to me, but more importantly, not my concern, as the burden of proof lies with the defender of Nawalt and not me. Now, let us tackle the second assumption. We have insight into what she currently considers trading up and has considered trading up at every opportunity presented to her. Again, some sort of catalog of values would need to exist that corresponds in a one-to-one relationship to each opportunity. Perhaps a defender of Nawalt could produce extensive reports from a psychologist, timestamp her incident. Again, the challenge to demonstrate this insight will be with the defender of Nawalt. Finally, let us eliminate the skepticism behind assumption 3, namely, she will not trade up in the future. To do this, we will need to go on a slight detour. First, we will need to talk about how time works. We're all familiar with the notions of past, present, and future. Now, the past is necessary because it has already occurred and cannot be changed, but the future is contingent. If we are to maximize our certainty of finding a Nawalt, surely we cannot go looking somewhere that is contingent, can we? Well, indeed we cannot. It then follows that we cannot look for a Nawalt among women who are currently alive. After all, if a woman is alive now, then it follows that it is possible that even though she has so far exhibited no signs of hypergamy, tomorrow she very well may be trading up. So it follows we must look for our Nawalt among the dead. So what we have said so far, it would follow that in order to find an example of Nawalt, we would need to produce evidence of the existence of opportunities to trade up. In addition to this, we would need to produce a compendium of all the incidents that transpired throughout the Nawalt candidate's life. For each incident, we would also need some deep psychological analysis that clearly and irrefutably displays the Nawalt candidate's values. Finally, this Nawalt candidate has to already be dead. Wow, well, it seems like a pretty high standard of evidence. In fact, this is an impossible standard of evidence. Impossible in the sense that this evidence does not exist for any person, nor would it be epistemologically certain even if we did dig up such evidence. It is at this point that a defender of Nawalt could accuse me of being unfair. Unfair because I have demanded an impossibly high standard of evidence needed to show an example of Nawalt. Let us not give them the opportunity, though. I formally drop these requirements for all defenders of Nawalt. I drop these requirements because I do not need any of them. I can prove to you that even without these standards of evidence, no man can produce a single example of a Nawalt. Now, let us look at the Nawalt argument one more time. 1. MGTOW assert that all women have potentiality for hypergamy. 2. Counterexamples exist of women who do not have potentiality for hypergamy. 3. Therefore, not all women are like what MGTOW described. Now, earlier, we had said that the burden of proof rests on MGTOW to prove that all women are like that. This is a consequence of premise 1 of the Nawalt argument. We have also said that the burden of proof rests on the defender of Nawalt to come up with a single example of Nawalt. This is a consequence of premise 2 of the Nawalt argument. Are not both premise 1 and premise 2 positive claims? Well, they certainly are. Could it not then be said that MGTOW make the claim that all women have hypergamy, whereas the defender of Nawalt claims the very opposite? Well, indeed it can. Therefore, both MGTOW and the defender of Nawalt make a positive claim to the ontological status of an opposite. So it seems MGTOW say the following: evidence exists of something that exists. And the defender of Nawalt says, evidence exists of something that does not exist. Can evidence exist of the non-existent? It cannot. Therefore, it is contradictory to assert that one can provide evidence of the non-existent. But perhaps this is all too confusing. Let me ask you a simple question. What evidence can you possibly show me that you do not have an airplane? None. Evidence for such a positive claim is impossible. In the same way, a defender of Nawalt cannot produce evidence that a woman does not have hypergamy, as potentiality for hypergamy would not exist in a Nawalt. So in this way, premise 2 of the Nawalt argument is false, as it is impossible to prove that a particular woman is an example of Nawalt. Simply put, you cannot prove a negative, and this is why the burden of proof is in the hands of the person making a positive claim towards that which is claimed to exist. Since the claim in premise 2 is a positive claim to the existence of a negative, it is dead in the water right out the gate. And with this, we have defeated the Nawalt argument on inductive grounds. We have shown that even if Nawalt did exist, which the deductive argument from the previous video demonstrated as false, it is impossible for someone to provide proof of their existence. However, a defender of Nawalt, though forced to abandon their current line of thinking, can provide a new argument. It would go as follows. 1. MGTOW assert that all women have potentiality for hypergamy. 2. MGTOW have not sufficiently proven that all women have potentiality for hypergamy. 3. Therefore, it has not been proven that all women have potentiality for hypergamy. This new argument is valid, and I consider it sound. I do not believe that MGTOW have sufficiently proven that all women have potentiality for hypergamy, gynocentrism, etc. This new argument, however, is not making a Nawalt claim. And perhaps the best way to understand my sentiment is with the following analogy. What we have in MGTOW at the moment is something akin to Newton's laws relating to gravity. But much like Einstein saw these laws insufficient to account for all he could observe, well, so too I see that there are some things that cannot be accounted for by our current theories. We need to work out the equivalent of the theory of general relativity as far as hypergamy, gynocentrism, you know, and so forth are concerned. We can see there are discrepancies in what we observe among women, things that, you know, do not cleanly fit our theories, observations that have served to divide our community. But we cannot look at these as Nawalts or refutations of our overarching thesis. We need to look at these examples as indicators that our work is not done in understanding hypergamy, gynocentrism, and so on. Our theories are incomplete and could still prove to be false. However, I would like to take a moment to explore what it would entail if Nawalt did exist. If Nawalt exists, then it follows that women exist who do not possess the potentiality for one or more attributes as enumerated in the conjunctive chain of attributes that MGTOW assert is true of all women. So, if a hypergamy Nawalt could somehow be found and proven to be as such, it would still not be the case that Nawalt is true. It would merely follow that hypergamy is not a potentiality women possess. Hypergamy, then, would need to be accounted for not as a property of women, but as something that is independent of women, but having an influence on some women while not on others. In such a scenario, MGTOW would need to demote hypergamy from potentiality to something like social pressure, you know, external to women but influential on women. In addition, MGTOW would need to remove hypergamy as a property of the conjunctive set of that which MGTOW claim all women are like. If indeed MGTOW did remove hypergamy from this conjunctive set, then the hypergamy Nawalt loses her Nawalt status, as it is no longer the case that MGTOW assert hypergamy as a property of women. Necessarily then, this hypergamy Nawalt falls back into the set of being exactly like all the women MGTOW claim her to be. This same logic would hold true for all properties MGTOW assert as part of the conjunctive set of properties true of all women. Finally, let us remember, I set out in these videos to defeat the Nawalt argument and not to prove that all women were hypergamous, gynocentric, or so on. To this end, I believe I have been successful in reaching my goal. MGTOW, as well as current Nawalt defenders, need to move away from the language of Nawalt because it is not useful to either camp. The Nawalt concept hurts MGTOW because it distracts from the mission of gathering evidence to prove as close to 100% as possible that all women can be observed engaging in, well, activities congruent with the claims MGTOW make. MGTOW need to not be wasting time and trying to account for examples based on, you know, highly limited and biased information about people's parents or grandparents or ex-girlfriends or who knows what. And the Nawalt concept also hurts defenders of Nawalt. You see, Nawalt defenders have a deeply hidden misconception within the concept of Nawalt. Those that believe that Nawalt exists implicitly assert that a Nawalt is a desirable woman. This does not logically follow. And the proof of this statement is as follows. Let us assume that MGTOW assert that all women are gynocentric and hypergamous, and nothing else. As we have previously shown, a Nawalt would then be a woman who fit one of the following three descriptions. 1. A woman who is only gynocentric but not hypergamous. 2. A woman who is only hypergamous but not gynocentric. 3. A woman who is not hypergamous and not gynocentric. Now, let us imagine a Nawalt defender found a Nawalt of the third kind, that he found a woman who is not gynocentric and not hypergamous. It would follow that he found a Nawalt, but it does not follow that he found a good woman. This Nawalt can be a compulsive liar or greedy. She could be lazy, she could be stupid, she could be frigid, she could have a mental disorder of some sort. You know, she could have a criminal background. She could be violent. She could be an ideologically brainwashed feminist. After all, it does not follow that a Nawalt could not be a feminist. You know, and this is but a short list of problems that a Nawalt could possess that are undesirable qualities. So, even if only half of all women are like what MGTOW described, you cannot make the claim that the 50% who you consider Nawalt are good women, or that you would even find them attractive. No, you are faced with the reality that of the percentage of women you might consider Nawalt, you will still need to heavily filter to find a decent one. For this reason, I believe the concept of Nawalt hurts defenders of Nawalt. The concept of Nawalt whitewashes women beyond the scope of what MGTOW assert is true of all women. After all, even if a woman won't trade you in for a better deal, she can still easily leave you out of boredom. There are reasons outside of hypergamy to leave a man, after all. Thanks for listening. Go team.